talk about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tom Boyd, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the state of the char. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tom Boyd about the state of the char. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboat, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at their ultimate personal flotation crafts. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Tom, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tom's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Tom's book, Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and also tickets to the Fly Fishing Show. So you have two chances to win tonight in our Q&A contest at the end. So here's how you win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question's going to be something that Tom and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, have fast fingers, and maybe you'll win one of these great prizes. Our guest tonight is Captain Tom Boyd. Tom is a fishing consultant, instructor, outdoor writer, editor, and lecturer. He has over 50 years of experience as a catch-and-release fly fisherman. As a professional fisherman, he has traveled the world in pursuit of fresh and saltwater species. He specializes in game fish behavior and developing techniques to catch even the toughest species. As a fishing advocate, he champions the sport to everyone. Tom's new book, Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish, Techniques and Tactics to Catch the Top 35 Species, and Notes on Rankings and Speed, is now available from Stackpole Books and Amazon. So check that out. Tom, hey, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
It's good to meet with you, Roger.
Yeah, good to have you back. And
Talking
about, a fish that doesn't get talked about too much, you know, in many of the periodicals and so forth. So it's going to be fun to explore the char tonight. And I guess my first question for you is, you know, why or how did you get so interested in char?
Well, Roger, I've been a fisherman for a long time, and back in the 80s, I traveled up to Labrador, and I was really struck by that country because I wasn't aware that, you know, how really remote it was and how that it was one of the largest unexplored pristine wilderness areas in the planet. At that time, they didn't even have any paved roads. They've got one now. But in any event, I was absolutely fascinated by the giant brook trout that I found and these giant landlocked Arctic char. And even back then, I was you know, a student of fish behavior and so forth. And I just saw these fish that were just weren't even on my radar scope. And one of the things I was able to do up there was explore. There was so much water. Maybe a third of that province is water. I mean, if you don't have a float plane, or if you don't have a boat or canoe or something like that, you just can't get around in that territory. So it fascinated me, and I met the Jack and Lorraine Cooper, who had taken over the Menapee camps, and this was an area that was fascinated Lee Wolf. He was a quite a pioneer and worked in the 1950s out of Goose Bay, Labrador, where there was a very large U.S. Air Force contingent, 13,000. And there really wasn't, that's a wilderness area. There was nothing for them to do. So he was hired to try to find places to fish and found many. And most of them suffered because of the pressure. But what he found in the Menapee Basin was special to him. And in any event, he made arrangements with a man named Cooper, not related to the Coopers that own the place today, that if he would protect and promote, you know, catch and release fishing and conservation practices, that he would let them know where that lake was. And he did. And that lake back then was called White's Lake. Today it's called Anne Marie Lake. And that's the center stone of the giant brook trout, giant landlocked Arctic char fishery in the world. I was able to do what Lee Wolf did, explore. My last visit there was this past year. My son Jeff and I are working on a new freshwater game fish book, and while we were there, we caught a giant landlocked Arctic char, which we feel is the rarest of the salmonoids in the world. The year before, I caught a 9-pound, 10-ounce giant brook trout and lost a bigger one. You know, that big one always gets away. So that's what started it. I became fascinated with the area, fascinated with the fish and how special they were. And in the early, in the late 80s and early 90s, we started doing research on these fish. And the Coopers, Jack Cooper, was a biologist. And he just loved it and encouraged it. And I brought in, you know, PhDs, the ichthyologists and things like that, marine biologists, you know, to help study these fish. So that's what got me started. It was the land, the people, and these absolutely fascinating brook trout and landlocked Arctic char. That's what got me started.
Yeah, it's really, like you say, it's kind of off the radar for a lot of people, I think, you know.
You know, Roger, when I go back, they didn't have a summer in Labrador last year. When I go back this year, we're looking to do some exploratory work and fish in some areas up there that have never been fished. It's incredible. If you look at a map, there's so much water there, it can never be fished, ever. So that's just one of these fascinating things to me, that there's still wild, wild, wild places. I mean, wolves don't know what you are. I walked up to wolves up there and got very close, and they just looked at me like, what's this ugly-looking animal? So it's a wild place.
Yeah. They still exist, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, you know, char is kind of loosely used word for a lot of different species. Do you want to break down what falls in the char family for us? And then we'll go into more detail on all these later.
Okay. Well, there are, generally speaking, char is a member of the Samanidae family that has in it salmon, trout, char, and whitefish. The char, there are five different species of char: brook trout, Arctic char, bull trout, Dolly Varden, and lake trout. Of those five species, four of them are anadromous. Anadromous meaning they're seafaring. They're spawned in fresh water, go out to sea, and then return. So basically, what we're talking about is, and I think the anadromous and the land-bound fish are different. So basically, we're talking about nine different fish. And the key ingredient here is you know, how a char differs from a trout, because they're brook trout, bull trout, they're not trout. Lake trout, they're not trout. So they kind of intermix the trout with char, and char are not trout. The primary difference is the vomerine bone is in the center of the mouth of a char and a trout. For trout, they have many teeth on the vomer. For char, they have only a few. So that's one of the, that's a key differentiating point between trout and char.
Okay, okay. I suppose in times past, because they look like trout, they got called trout, like bull trout or brook trout or those kind of things, and those names stuck.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, they again, it's been very, very difficult even for contemporaneous geneticists to tell the difference between some of these fish. You know, when they look similar, you know, again, they're called trout. I mean, it was, I think, pretty much out of ignorance. You know,
yeah.
We really hadn't done the genetic work or whatever. And so they were called, and different names, you know, like in colonial times, for example, brook trout and sea run trout were very, very common and the favorite fish of the colonialists and extremely common. They called the sea run trout salters, you know, because they came in from the salt. But again, out of, you know, just not knowing, they refer to them in trout. They have all, you know, similar appearing bodies, and, you know, they sometimes their ranges overlap and that kind of stuff. So it was just,
yeah.
It was easy to call a char a trout.
Yeah, we got a couple of questions. I just want to give them credit. Craig in Portland, Oregon, and Steen in Denmark both were asking about the differences. And we can talk more about that as we dig in. But
sure.
Steen mentioned he's in Denmark. He says the only char they have there are in Greenland.
Yeah.
Good way to put it. So
well,
I guess char in Greenland as well, which is not too far from Labrador.
Well, char are the northernmost freshwater game fish. They are circumpolar. So if you get to, you know, if you're looking for char, you know, you've got to go right around, you know, you're talking Labrador, Ungava, Nunavut, Northwest Territories, Alaska, you know, you can jump across the Bering Sea to Russia and the Kamchatka Peninsula and go there to all the way across Russia to, you know, Scandinavia and from there to Iceland and from there to Greenland. So
Yeah. You're
not catching these guys in Florida.
Do they not exist in the southern hemisphere?
They do not. They have. Why they haven't been transplanted, I don't know. So many of the different salmons have been transported there. You know, trout, rainbow trout, brown trout. You know, most of, you know, brook trout have been transported everywhere. Probably the reason is they require such cold water. There again, and one of the absolute fascinating things to me about char. Here they require, they are almost all made of fresh water. At 32 degrees, they freeze, they die. And yet, they're the most northern, you know, game fish species we have, and they exist in salt water. Salt water freezes at 24.8 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can have, there's a lot of water that's between 24.8 and 32 degrees, and any of that kind of water, a char will freeze in. This is the same for a Dolly Varden, too. Again, and these are the northernmost game fish. So what they have to do is the habitat is extremely limited because here they are in these incredibly cold, Spartan areas. They have to find a place that has enough food, but that has extremely cold water, and there's enough, the ice doesn't freeze straight to the ground where they can survive. So it's not an easy fish to transplant. You take any of the trout species and many of the salmon species, their habitat requirements are much more lenient than char. You take typical trout or salmon and put them in the extremely Spartan areas that Arctic char or Dolly Varden survive in, and often bull trout, and they won't survive. They just, they won't survive. They can't. You have, like one of the features of a Dolly Varden, they feed, they'll be in a river that's sterile, and all of a sudden in that river you'll have a salmon run, and the salmon will come in and lay their eggs, and the Dolly Varden will feast on those eggs until they extend their stomachs and their intestines, because most of the energy that they take up is with their stomach and digestive system. So when there's food available and they expand on that food, they not only eat the eggs, they'll eat the flesh of dying salmon, and they'll eat, you know, like you can use flesh flies, because any particles, they clean up the river, and when you get like larvae of blowflies that fester on salmon, they eat those. And so it's feast or famine. They'll absolutely devour those. And the salmon are there for, you know, 2, 3, 4 months, in some cases a little longer, but then they leave. There's no more food in that river. They don't have any insect hatches. And so their digestive systems and their stomachs contract, and they're half what their normal size is. And they sit there and they wait until the next year. Trout, salmon, they can't do that. These are, of all the salmonidae, Robert Behnke, and as far as my knowledge is, he was the number one scientific expert on this family of species. He spent over 25 years, you know, studying them. And he said they were the most adaptable, you know, of all the species. The only thing is, I thought, then why didn't they adapt to Florida, you know? But what they did was they took their extremely sterile, Spartan environment of the north and learned how to survive in it. I mean, it's an incredible story.
So if you're, you know, I spoke to you about this once before when I was up on my dad, my son, and I were up on the Togiak River in Alaska, Bristol Bay.
Mm-hmm.
We went up a side creek called Cache Creek, and we had one of the best days fishing in our lives up there, and a lot had to do with char and Dolly Varden, Arctic char and Dolly Varden. And they were doing just what you were saying. They were all sitting behind the kings who were finishing up their spawn, and we had to kind of nymph through the kings to get to the Dolly Vardens, which was
yep.
Catch. But so would that be a potentially kind of sterile creek other parts of the year, and would they move then into the Togiak River when that becomes
pretty much it, you know, Roger? The key is the latitude and the richness. For example, landlocked Arctic char, there are very few places on Earth where landlocked Arctic char can survive. I only know of, there might be more, but I only know of two areas that are productive for landlocked Arctic char. And the reason is the areas that they exist in, like the northernmost range, is in Ellesmere Island in the Arctic. And that lake, they have to come piscivorous. They have to eat themselves because there's nothing else in that lake to eat. So the big fish eat the littler fish. And in any event, there's just these two areas. One of them is the Menapee Basin, and I think that is a very productive area, and the largest landlocked Arctic char in the world by far are there, because they've morphed into something that is a unique fish, and they feed in a rich area filled with flies, lots of mice, lots of lemmings, lots of food, lots of sculpins, lots of lake chubs, and things like that for them to feed on. So they've adopted a lot of the habitats of their cohabitants, which are brook trout. The only other area that I know of where char get fairly large is in the northern Scandinavia. There's a couple of lakes where most of the char are half of a pound to maybe 2 or 3 pounds. There's a record there. I think it's about 7 pounds, but again, the average fish in the Menapee area is about 6 or 7 pounds. Char, for example, there's many names, blueback char, sunapee, trout. They're char, and typically they get, a big one would be maybe 12 inches. Mostly these were fish that inhabit New Hampshire and Maine. The Rangeley Lakes used to house maybe the biggest brook trout in the world, as big as those in the Menapee. They're extinct now, but they fed on blueback char, which were extremely, extremely numerous in the Rangeley Lakes. But they put landlocked Atlantic salmon in there, which are great fish, but didn't belong there, and they put smelt in and pushed out the blueback char, killed all of them, and made the Rangeley trout species extinct.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. And then, so, I know there's a lot of Arctic char in, of course, Dolly Varden up in Alaska, but as what you're saying, they don't get to the size, the Arctic char?
Well, all of the char that are in northern Alaska are Dolly Varden. They call them char because Dolly Varden have a bad name. I'm talking about all of the anadromous, all the ones running in the rivers. Again, there's some landlocked Dolly Varden and so on and so forth. But, you know, they call them char because Dolly Varden have a bad name. The Dolly Varden were given a bad name, you know, many, many years ago. They did a study, and again, they couldn't, back then, this was starting in the teens, and by 1921, I think through 1941, they had a bounty that was paid anywhere on a Dolly Varden tail. It was kind of like scalps, you know. So, and the bounty varied anywhere, mostly from a half a cent to 2 cents, but I've heard as even as much as a nickel. But in any event, the reason they put this bounty on the Dolly Varden is that they thought there were two piscivorous, that they were eating the alvins and the parr and even the smolt of salmon and trout, you know, rainbow trout. So they thought that, you know, this is a nasty predator. And by the way, they totally misjudged them. Of, you know, the Arctic char and Dolly Varden and bull trout are extremely close looking. They look the same, but they sure as hell don't act the same. I can tell what they are by how they act. And if you're fishing, for example, in an area and you've got Arctic char and Dolly Varden co-inhabiting at the same time, and that happens a lot.
Right.
And in any event, if you put down eggs, the Arctic char and the Dolly Varden will eat salmon eggs. If you put down, say, a big leech pattern, a char will eat it, a Dolly Varden won't. You know, when I was fishing over Dolly Varden and could catch one, I was fishing on the Pebble Mine site. Tremendous, as good a Dolly Varden fishing as I've ever seen. Literally, my son and I were catching one fish for every other cast, landing a fish. We missed a number of them and so on and so forth. When we put down, and just tons of dollies, it was just red with dollies. When we put down experimentally leech patterns, I'd make 20 or 30, 40 casts before I could catch a fish. You know, with an egg, we got a hit every single solitary time. If they would have been char, they wouldn't have cared. I'd have caught them with an egg pattern or, you know, with a leech pattern.
Yeah.
So their behavior is very different.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break here, Tom, and when we come back, let's continue on our conversation with Dolly.
Sounds good.
Dug into them. So we'll be right back and talking more about the state of the char.
Thank you.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Boyd about the state of the char. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tom, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So I know you finished the greatest, your book, now I forgot.
Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish.
Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish, there we go. And
yeah, loved it. There's some really new techniques in that book that have never been in print before. And since then, I was in an automobile accident, and I've really been spending a lot of time just with maintenance. I was hurt pretty severely. But so my son Jeff, who is also an avid fisherman and has fished with me, I used to take him on my back. He's helping me with write our next book, and we're writing. It's on Samanadi, the top tactics and behavior of char, salmon, and trout. And what we've done is we've picked out, not all of them, there are too many to cover, but we've picked out the top dozen and a half, you know, species of salmon, char, and trout. And what we're doing is putting a great deal of techniques. I think there is more information in there about behavior of these species and techniques to catch them than anything I'm aware of in print. So we've really been working hard on this, and it's a labor of love. We've used these kind of, you know, we've used observations because we've been able to fish in the best places in the world, you know, for a lifetime. And often we could go in and use, you know, materials and equipment that wasn't available to other people, you know. I was able to go into, you know, the Menapi watershed, and I could, you know, we got experimental licenses with Canada's DFO, that's their Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and they would give us, you know, permits for tagging and taking, you know, samples and that kind of stuff. But the people that we fish with all over from Newfoundland and Labrador, they would allow us to bring in, like, fish finders. They would allow us to use whatever techniques that we needed to catch the fish. We were even given permission to, you know, fish past the deadline of the season and things like that. And in fact, in going back in the early 90s, I was a consultant for Canada, their DFO, and we worked on so many projects. I was really happy to work with getting the gill nets taken down from Newfoundland and Labrador, which I think restored the Atlantic salmon fishery, and we started in 1992, and the last nets were put in Labrador in 98, and already the Arctic char fishery and sea-run brook trout fisheries are starting to respond. So the char are coming along slowly because they're much longer lived than Atlantic salmon, but, you know, we've been able to do stuff like that and learn, and that's the kind of stuff that we're putting in our book. Because we use the behavior. If you understand why the fish do what they do and when they do it, that leads to determining the kind of tactics and techniques that you need to catch them.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds great. Sounds like an exciting project.
It really is.
So when you get close to publishing that, we'll have to get back on again and talk about that book.
Oh, you bet. I'd love it.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds good. Well, great. Let's dig in more to the Dolly here, because you wanted to talk about, you know, some of the best places to go for them and how to fish for them and some flies. And I know I want to throw this question out right now because it might have to do with dollies. I don't know, but we got one in on the internet here. Bernard Chin in Santa Monica. I recently became curious about fishing in Iceland, especially on a more do-it-yourself basis. I understand that there are quality native char opportunities there. Might you have any insights that you can share with respect to pursuing them in Iceland?
Is he talking char or Dolly Varden?
He just says native char. He doesn't specify.
Okay, because they're Arctic char. They're an anadromous char. They're, and as far as catching techniques for char or Dolly Varden, I would throw them in there, and bull trout. They are what you call obligate feeders. They're in a Spartan environment. They have to take advantage of their opportunity. So whether you have, you know, an anadromous char in Iceland or in Nunavut or in the Kamchatka Peninsula, you know, or wherever, or the Tree River in on Victoria Island, that char has to take advantage when they can. Now, the char, they have a much wider, they spend most of their lives, almost all of their lives, in fresh water. They feed in salt water for maybe 3 or 4 months. So they're going to be coming in there to overwinter. But unlike like salmon that come in to spawn and die, they're going to come in and they're still gregarious. They want to eat. You know, that's what they do. So they're a little different when you catch them right in salt water, and I'm going to do this in Ungava next year, hopefully, catch char and Atlantic salmon and sea-run brook trout before they enter into, you know, their natal rivers. Well, in Iceland, before they come in, they're really, when they, because they'll form aggregates, they'll right before they come into the their natal river. And those rivers they're coming in is where they were born. Chances are about 90%. So if you want to fish for them right before, when they're still in the salt, you know, they're looking for big, you know, maybe sticklebacks or big streamer patterns. Once they move into fresh water, they'll usually hang out in fresh water just to get acclimated, you know, they're, because it's a different, it's, you know, it might be brackish, but again, fresh water is different than salt water. And they'll usually hang around for, you know, several days, 3 or 4 days, and they're aggressive. I mean, these guys are aggressive. I mean, I love to catch them on top of the water with poppers, you know, but they like bright colored streamers, you know, and usually when they come in, they might hold in deeper water. So sink tip lines, full sink, you know, big streamers that move a lot of water, or big poppers that are on top of the water. If you're in, if the entry is, say, wide and shallow, you know, go to something on, you know, on the top, and bright colored poppers. They like orange, they like purple, they like black, they like combinations, you know, of those kind of things. And then once they move upstream, once the char move upstream, they become different kind of animals. And it, I don't know how long, the rivers in Iceland are not typically long, but say, for example, you had a 100-mile river. What char do is, and almost always, and they'll be continuously coming in, you know, over several months, but they'll find a place in the river and they'll congregate. You might have 100 miles of river, they might hold in 1 mile of that. And what they'll do is, they'll find their, they absolutely love to find a feeder stream. You know, you get a feeder stream, often they'll stop right there. And now that they're in the river, they're fully in fresh water. Again, their appetites change. And one of the best ways, a lot of the things they eat in the ocean are krill or scud, you know, shrimp-type creatures. So I like to use an indicator and put like a pink-red beadhead krill pattern or shrimp pattern and just drop it. You can fish it with an indicator or not, but they'll hammer that. And the key to finding and catching char is finding where they're at in a river. And that's true also of dollies, and that's true of bull trout. You know, you can go after mile after mile after mile after river, and you can see them. They move, they breach, they create a ruckus. But when you find a feeder stream or some good structure, or they don't handle big falls. They'll go up, there's it like, you know, brook trout or will go up at bigger falls, believe it or not, than a char will. So that you get a big falls, that's the end of their journey. You know, I mean, a big fall, if it can be 4 or 5 feet, you know, unless the tide rises and brings them up over that, they won't go over it. So I would use, depends on how long they've been in the river and what stage of the rivers they're in. But the key is, if you fish a little bit and you don't catch one, move. Because again, they're obligate feeders. They're not gonna, they don't pass something up. You know, they're not a fish like some wily brown trout that's seen it all and's got a PhD and says, that fly's not tied well enough to me, and, you know, that tippet, that leader's, you know, only 12 feet. I'm not chewing on anything unless it's got a 24 foot. You know, these guys are obligate eaters, and they're gonna, so if you cast and they don't take, move, because the fish probably are not there.
Yeah, and that's probably why, like that day on the Cache Creek for us, you know, we were doing triples and one, again and again after each other. I mean, they were just hitting everything, it seemed like.
And you might have gone upstream. Yeah, you might have gone upstream, you know, a mile, and you wouldn't find any
fish. Got nothing. Yeah.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I've marveled in Labrador, and I've asked the smartest people that I know of, PhDs, that is their business to know, we'd walk mile after mile after mile after mile, the most beautiful water you've ever seen in your life that was absolutely barren, totally. And we'd take pH and water, you name it. We'd look for insects. We'd do the, and we couldn't tell one stretch of water from another, and all of a sudden, there'd be fish. And I'd ask, you know, the PhDs, you know, why? And it's like, why didn't you bring your homework? You know, because, you know, I don't know. You know, so there's no, I'm sure that their senses are so much more acute than ours. There was a reason, but neither me nor anybody else that I've been able to figure out, you know, understands, you know, why that is, you know, because we, the normal things that you would think of, that they didn't have any, you know, water temperature, flow, you know, good hatches, structure, but, you know, you'd find a piece of water that had everything you could want, you know, if you, you know, if God designed a trout stream, he'd say, this is the, these are the components, and you'd have that and no fish, so.
Yeah, interesting, very interesting. Let's take another quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll dig into more good information about the char, so hang tight, we'll be right back. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option, wade fishing trips, or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Tour their website at www.dryflies.com and visit the, view the fishing products and guide services they have to offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Boyd about the state of the char. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at Ask About Fly Fishing and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so lots of techniques and information about the Dolly Varden and an Arctic char. And I know when we were fishing that day on Cache Creek, we were finding both of them mixed in, along with grayling, in the same stretch.
Sure.
And you didn't know what you were going to get, really. But there they were. The Dollies were feeding on, like, a black nymph, you know, very nondescript. I think it was AP Black is what they were hitting on.
And, let me ask you, how'd you know they were dollies?
The guide, well, we caught two different fish. I'll have to send you the pictures. the dollies seemed to be longer and slender. You know, I mean, the guide was telling us they were dollies. The char were more, had much more color to them as far as spawning colors were going, and were just incredibly, you know, vibrant and their coloration. And I believe the Arctic char had more of a hooked jaw kind of thing, if I remember right. It's been a long time since I looked at the picture.
Well, the truth be known, not many of the guides, and frankly not many people alive, can tell the difference when they're in the same water. I did this, you know, and I know the differences. My son Jeff, you know, we know the differences. And we were fishing, maybe the... When we were fishing with Jerry Jakes, and he's sportsman's, it's the Bristol Bay Sportsman and Adventure Lodge, and we were right on the Pebble Mine site, and this is where we were, this is the best dolly fishing that, you know, that I'd ever had, and there were char in the water too, and Jeff and I caught one, I don't know, and we started talking, what is this? Is this a char? Is this a Dolly Varden? And we went back and forth. And we kind of figured that maybe it was a hybrid, but there are really a lot of differences. You know, the only way that you can really tell for sure, though, is you got to open them up. You know, if there's, to me, when I see Dolly Varden can be every bit as colorful as a char. I think, although some of the char, like from the Tree River, if nobody had ever seen one of these fish before, and saw how incredibly vibrant they can be, they would think that it was a phony fish, that nothing could look like that. So I think it's only a small step behind that dollies are, But there are, if you open them up, there's two things. There's, you know, there's their gill rakes, which, you know, are, there are more in a dolly. I'm sorry, there are more in a char than there are in a dolly. So a char's got somewhere between 25 and 30 gill rakes, and they're a little sharper pointed than those of a dolly. Dolly only has 21 or 22 rakes. And there's one other absolute killer. If you, again, you'd have to dissect them, you know, to do this, and I don't like to do it. I'm a catch and release guy, but I have done this once or twice just to make sure. But they've got right below their stomach and their intestine, they have these worm-like appendages, and what they're called cica. And if for one, if it was one cica, but and sometimes they call it pyloric cica. But when they have more, they're called cecum. And so you can count them. And if like an Arctic char has got 45 of those or so on the intestines, whereas a Dolly Varden only has about two-thirds that many, or about 30. So that's a definite. But there are other things that how you can tell the difference. For example, on their kype, if you get a Dolly Varden, it has a more pronounced kype, and a kype is the jaw. It gets extended, and some salmon, like an Atlantic salmon, it's really totally distorted, and some of the Pacific as well. But in a Dolly Varden, the lower part of their kype, the lower jaw, is more extended than it is on a char, and not only that, it turns, the ball on the kype turns black, whereas on a typical char, and again, there's 24 different morphs of char, so they vary interspecies-wise, but, and I don't want to get too technical here, but generally speaking, the char's kype is smaller, and it'll be orangish rather than black and more defined. And a bull trout isn't quite as defined as it's made to a char, but not as colorful. It's more creamy colored. So that's one of the ways that you can tell. But they tell the difference by the size of the dots, the spots on a char. If you get a char, the spots are larger than the pupil of that char's eye. Okay, they're light pink on a dark black background, whereas Dolly Varden, their spots, they're the same kind of color, but they're smaller and way more numerous. So they got many, many more, and they're smaller than the pupil of a Dolly Varden's eye. So that's an easy way to tell them apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we get to maybe I'll bring my photos and see what you can tell from the photos.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. But I'll tell you, this again. I talked about Bob Behnke, Roger. I had more respect for Bob Behnke. He was unbelievable. He worked at Colorado State University, and I never met him, but I talked to him on the phone, and I corresponded with him, and I sent samples and all that kind of stuff. We were trying to get some things, you know, genetically identified as unique morphs, unique fish, and these were the Menapi, brook trout, and char. In any event, the most perplexing thing that Bob Behnke ever endeavored in, and he lived into his early 80s, and was trying to tell the difference between an Arctic char and a Dolly Varden.
Wow.
And a bull trout. And he spent over 25 years traveling the world doing DNA work. He was the best. He traveled to Kamchatka, where the original definition of a char, of its range and its characteristics, was defined. I went to museums. He studied skull heads, and on and on and on and on. 25 years.
Wow, he was obsessed.
In 1980, he wrote a 925-page book on char and on the differences between these three species. And again, nobody had ever done anything even remotely similar to that.
No.
And it was no sooner in print than experts all around the world were telling him he was full of crap, that wasn't so, that you know, and on and on and on. So,
yeah.
And in fact, there's been so much misidentification of of these species. For example, bull trout used to inhabit the southernmost part of the range was the McLeod River. And at one year, a little girl went in there and said, and the bull trout, when they were spawning, they had a dark green kind of background and pink spots. And one of the Charles Dickens characters was called Dolly Varden, and she wore on stage this dress that had those similar colors, and she suggested they should call these fish Dolly Varden, and they did. So they were called Dolly Varden. And the problem was they weren't Dolly Varden, and all the other ones like that, they weren't Dolly Varden. They really were bull trout. You know, they wiped them out and they built a dam there. But, you know, the bottom line is nobody, it's really, really difficult. Nobody's comfortable with trying to tell the difference between a Dolly Varden and a char. I've been with guides, and I would ask them, because I ask everybody. I never tell anybody anything. We learn because we want to hear. There's so much you can learn from guides that know a river intimately, and, you know, or lodge owners and so on and so forth. And we would ask and get, and often would get back, you know, we were hoping that you could tell us, you know.
It seems to me like, you know, when people were saying that the results in the study were not accurate, you know, I suppose that's going to vary from area to area with the same kind of fish. I mean, dollies probably act differently in Labrador than they do in Bristol Bay or in Scandinavia. I know because...
Well, some do. It depends on the latitude, but, you know, but the bottom line is, like, the size and how they look, that can vary, Roger, river to river. You can be in, say, if you're in Alaska, you can go in a river and a typical Dolly Varden might be 6 pounds, you know, or a big one. You might go to the next river, you know, 10 miles north, you know, and they might have fish to 12 pounds. The Tree River, they just found they extended the range of Dolly Varden. They thought that the Dolly Varden stopped at the Bering Sea. They Chukchuk Sea or the Beaufort Sea, they didn't go into those areas. And that's, you know, north, that's northern Alaska moving east, you know, all the way to the Tree River. Well, they found a giant species of Dolly Varden in the Tree River, you know, just a few years ago. So that extended their range probably 800 miles to the east. So they're still learning. As a matter of fact, at one time, the world record Dolly Varden was in an Idaho lake, Lake Pend Oriel, and it was a 32-pound, some-odd-ounce fish. And then they found out it wasn't a Dolly Varden, and IGFA was a world record, so they had to change it. It was a bull trout. So, by the way, I could go forever. We could talk all night on misidentification of these fish.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'll just sum it up, there's a lot of other differences in them. They're panuncle, the shape of their heads. Bull trout have really big heads and compared to their bodies and slimmer bodies and on and on and on and on. But the thing that really differentiates them to me is their behavior, because they might look the same, but they don't act the same. And again, I can tell, I'll be with a guy and we'll be teasing, what is that, you know? And I'll say, I'll tell you, because I'll put a streamer on and throw a streamer out in a, you know, a multitude of fish, and they ignore it, you know, and I say, they're dollies. So anyway,
let's talk about bull trout then, kind of segue into them and talking more about them. Now, I know they've become, we find them up in northern, on the Kootenai River up there, that area.
Oh yeah, I just fished it very, very recently, just last month. It was my last last trip was on the Kootenai.
Oh, good, good. Well, tell us about, you know, the state of the bull trout, because I know they're having problems up there, I think, and you can't actually target them, I think, right?
Well, you can there, but most places, for example, almost all the areas that bull trout inhabit in the United States are troubled. You know, typically their original range in the United States was from Northern California up the coast, Oregon, Washington, but they were inland, you know, Idaho, I believe Northern Nevada. But the absolute central area, the core area for bull trout was in British Columbia. You know, a lot of the rivers that ran into, you know, like the Skeena River drainage, and all of those areas were good for bull trout. And the range would go right up through most of British Columbia, and to a degree, if you go a little bit west to southwest Alberta, and there were also some in the Yukon and the Northwest Territories. Well, everywhere in the United States, as far as I'm aware, are bull trout are endangered. You know, they're, you know, maybe the, you know, the best place for bull trout in the United States, I would think, would be, you know, on the Olympia Peninsula. And there's the Elwha River used to be a great place, and they put a dam, and they trap some bull trout above it, and they're still managing, and they're working on the, to restore the anadromous population. But there's nowhere that they're doing well except in the Fernie area of British Columbia. And I went up there. I fished with the Kootenai Fly Shop and Guide Service, Gordy Silverthorne, and he brought in a fellow that, that they partnered up and built a tent camp up on the Kootenai River, and Eric Grinnell was his partner. And a renowned fisherman named Cam Ziegler, I knew his father and know him, he's the spit of his dad. We went up there in October, mid-October, and to fish for bull trout. And these are next to lake trout. Bulls are the biggest. And historically, they've been known to get to 40 pounds. You know, these are big, long, big-headed, slimmer-bodied, but long. 30 inches is a, you know, not a big bull trout. They get well over 40. These are big fish. They're extremely aggressive. And Cam and I went up in late October because this was prime time for bull trout to be taken on big flies, foot-long flies, streamers. And what we did was the bull trout, they feed, they're piscivores, they eat fish. And there is a Kokanee salmon run that is finished like in October. And by late October, they're either dead or dying. And the bull trout just scoop those guys up. And there's also a whitefish population there, and they feed on them as well. But we were making, we had flies that we were casting that were, you know, 10 to 12 inches long and more that imitated kokanee. You know, and the kokanee, when they were dying, had a lot of white, a lot of purple, that kind of stuff. And these bull trout, they're in a river that there's really isn't anything else. And to compound our problem, they had the worst flood ever. That river was, and it's steep, and you get a real heavy rain, it clears very quickly. Well, they had the heaviest rains they ever had. That river went up over 3 feet, and it washed all of the kokanee, all of their eggs right downstream. They were gone. So here we are in this sterile river, the worst time we could be there. We still caught, Cam and I averaged 3 bulls per day, and plus some really nice, they have the largest population of western slope cutthroats there too, the purest strain. So despite, normally you're catching 6, 8, 10 bull trouts a day, and I don't know of any other place on the planet that you can do that except waters that are near there. The top waters for bull trout are not only the Kootenai River, and again, Cam and I stayed in a tent camp because we wanted to be out where the fish were. We didn't want to run very far, and so they put that tent camp up for us. But there's also a couple of other rivers that are really productive. The Wigwam River, it's absolutely stunning, clear, clean water, you know, shallow, has, you know, big bulls, and one of the world records is there.
The U.S. or Canada, Wigwam, I'm not familiar with that.
Yes, yes. And also there's Elk Creek.
Which?
I'm sorry.
U.S. or Canada is the Wigwam?
Wigwam, all of these are in British Columbia. They're all in the Fernie, British Columbia area. You know, the Kootenai, the Elk Creek, the Wigwam River, these are the top, as far as I know, 3 bull trout producers in the country. They've got a few other things. They've got a small Michelle Creek where you can catch, you know, 4, 5, 6 pound cutthroats all day long, and what feeds on them are bull trout. So you got these are all the Kootenai is a big river, but it's wadeable. We'd get on the sandbars and get right out and wade. You know, we fished very little. A few spots we had to fish from the boat because, you know, structure and trees and all that kind of stuff. But, and by the way, that's what bull trout love. But when you're fishing for them, we saw them come from 8-10 feet deep holes and right to the surface and eat a fly. I mean, they're obligate feeders. They see what they think is a meal. They're going to move. A lot of fish you talked about king salmon. Sometimes you might have to float something right in their mouth. They're not going to move. Either they'll move their body, but they're not going to move to eat something. Well, bull trout will move 8, 10, 12 feet to eat something. You know, unprecedented amongst the salmonidae, I think.
Yeah. We got a question from Dave in Mesa, Colorado, specifically about the bull trout. Two questions. He says, how are the recovery efforts in Montana and the lower 48, and is there any indication that they will be removed from the protected list? That's question.
Well, they're not doing well anywhere. They were never a really, populist species. You know, they always, you know, they're, you compare them to all of the other char or all of the other salmonidae, and I think they had, you know, the most limited range. So, you know, they're working hard, but the best bull trout, you know, populations in the United States, again, I think are on the, you know, Elwha River in Washington State. They're working on them in the Puget Sound. Again, they're everywhere that I know in the U.S. They're on the endangered species list. You can catch them incidentally in Montana, Idaho, Montana. That area, the Clark's Fork is a good place, and what else? Maybe the Flathead River. But typically, Roger, you're not saying, "Well, I'm going to go out and go bull trout fishing."
No.
The people that catch the bull trout, they're fishing for something else in the United States anyway,
and
it's an incidental catch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, I think we're working hard on it, but, you know, we don't have the money, and it's a difficult species. It's a difficult species. Its needs are sometimes beyond, they've done some great things in management things in British Columbia, like they introduced in these Spartan rivers, they introduced years ago, starting in, I think, 1908, they put kokanee in to feed these fish. And that just worked out great. And when the bull trout population crashed, it was because the kokanee population crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So they've done some things like that. And unless we do some very aggressive management things like that in the United States, I think they'll probably linger and stay on the endangered species list.
The second question Dave had was, has there ever been any efforts to introduce bull trout anywhere else in the United States, for example, Wyoming, Colorado, or even the East?
Well, they haven't been. I would say no. I mean, nothing that of any significance that I'm aware of. Again, by the time they even figured out what bull trout were, and by the way, you know, when they figured out what a bull trout was, and a guy from Ohio State and 1978, I think his name was Grinnell. He figured out what that a bull trout was a separate species. So, I mean, I don't think we even realized until, you know, maybe the 80s or 90s that they were a special species on their own and that they were in trouble. You know, so, you know, it isn't till, you know, within, you know, our lifetime that we even figured these guys what they were. One, and two, that they were in trouble. So the answer I would say is no. You know, they exist in a number of the Rocky Mountain states, but in very minor numbers, and it's a very tenuous existence at best.
Okay, let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up talking about brook trout. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company and is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service, located in North Carolina at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains. They fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience in the area. And in addition to the backcountry guide service, they offer extensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go ahead and spend a day with them in Fly Fishing Paradise. For more information on their services, please visit nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com. Or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tom Boyd about the state of the char. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so Tom, brook trout. We've got seafaring brook trout. We've got freshwater brook trout, right? So the salters.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I don't have it handy, but there was just I was going to send it to you. There was an article. It was either in like Fly Rod and Reel or Fly Fisherman about salters out on Long Island, I believe, or somewhere. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. But I'm aware there's a lot of restorative efforts for brook trout in not only on Long Island. By the way, Long Island's that's Daniel Webster's salter. You know the. There's different dates. That one says 1821, another 1826 that was caught. First it was 13.8 pounds, and later it was 14.5 pounds. But that was, caught on Long Island. And in colonial days, from, Long Island all the way up through the New England states, all the way up through Atlantic Canada, there were lots of sea-run brook trout, and they call them salters, and they're frankly they're very different from landlocked brook trout. We've been interested in them because, well, the restorative methods that they're using in Massachusetts on Long Island, and many of them in Maine. There's probably several dozen restorative efforts. And those salter brook trout, they're a big one would be maybe 12 inches. Most of the, we're talking fish that are as adults are 3, 4, 5, 6 inches long, mostly.
And oh, wow! I was thinking that they'd be bigger, having gone to sea.
You would think so. Well, even the salters when they go to sea, they really don't go to sea like a salmon would go, and neither do the char. These are shore huggers. They go out to brackish water. They stay right often close to their natal rivers. They might go up and down the coastline if they get a run of shrimp or some sort of a bait fish. But they stay in shallow brackish water, which is much richer than the streams that they're born in. But there's a half a dozen or more restorative areas on sea run trout. I've started a couple of tagging programs, and I've tried to locate the finest areas for sea-run brook trout that remain on the planet. And in order to find them, the southernmost range is in the north coast of Quebec, right before it hits Labrador, or for the St. Lawrence Seaway. And there are a number of areas that have sea-run brook trout, and I've talked to people that I know that have caught a 7 3/4 pound sea run brookie that a friend of hers caught one that was much bigger. That she didn't have a scale. My friend did, and they said it was much bigger. So there's some big sea run brook trout up there. What I did was I asked around in my research, and I found out that possibly the best run for sea run brookies was in the Big River, and that's a famous Atlantic salmon river. And I called and made an appointment to go up there, and I got permission, from the owner of the lodge, the Big River, to start a tagging program. And again, we've been running tagging programs for many years, like on the brook trout. And they're wonderful things. Like the brook trout and the minipie, we started, doing fin clips back in the 80s. In the 90s, we started tagging them. In the late 90s, in 1998 and 1999, we tagged two brook trout that were, and they were 4 and 5 year old trout that we recaptured in 2014 and 2015. That means they were 20 years old and counting.
Wow.
You know, nothing is, even William Flick and this Cornell in the 60s and 70s, the oldest trout, and he studied all the big areas, you know, for trout, you know, Assiniboine, the Mistassini, the Broadback River, the Menapi, he traveled to all of the great places, and I think a 7-year-old trout was the oldest he found. I found one by counting that you can count their rings under magnification, their olegraph rings and their scales. It's like a tree. You can tell how old the fish is. You can tell how many times they've spawned. There's a gap in it, an opening if they haven't spawned. So you can get age and things like that. Chart. More difficult. You have to open their ear to get to the olegraph ear organs inside their head to get that data. But anyway, we started these tagging programs on brook trout. And, of course, they had no summer in Labrador, and the brook trout didn't show up, the sea run, the salters. So we went down to the sea, and part of the Big River Range, they had a wonderful, wonderful brook, and we went up that brook and we found the sea run trout there, and we found them, you know, by the thousand. We didn't catch any big ones. The biggest one that I saw was about maybe 5 pounds, but we talked to some of the guides at the lodge that had been there. One had been there for 48 years, and he said they never went after brook trout, and they hold in different water than Atlantic salmon. But as an incidental catch, they had caught them to 7.5 pounds, and he thought they got bigger. But next year, we're going to go down in the brook that we went to with the okay of Judy Normore, who runs that lodge, was Rattling Brook. And nobody's ever been up. There's a falls there, and it's a tidal thing where the big Atlantic salmon and brook trout can get up that falls, and we're going to go up that this summer. I might add, we're going to be hosting some trips at the Menapi camp for a couple of weeks this year and doing our studies if people are interested in going. I'm just announcing that now. I just put it on my Facebook page today, and we're going to be doing some things in the Kootenai for the bull trout. We're going to be doing some things up in Ungava Bay and searching for sea-run brookies and Arctic char. And we're going to be going to Alaska in the first 2 weeks in November, hosting groups that might be interested in the Dolly Varden and the char. And, of course, there's lots of salmon in there at that time and rainbows. You know, those rainbows, when you mentioned the grayling, they're in there, but those rainbows are in there, too. My son and I were catching and looking at 10-pound and up rainbows that were feeding right in amongst the, you know, the Dolly Varden and the sockeye salmon and the grayling, and, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. It gets to be a crazy day when you're catching all these different fish, you know.
It really is. Well, the Bristol Bay area of Alaska is the center of the universe for, you know, trout and salmon fishing as far as I'm concerned. I mean,
before I lose the thought, where you said if people want to find out about your trips that you're hosting and stuff, it's Facebook. Is that the best place to go?
Just Tom Boyd Fishing, on Facebook. I have a website, but I'm pretty computer illiterate, and I put some of my articles on there, but I'm not up to date on that. But, the Facebook, that's a great place for them to, you know, to see what we're up to. And in addition, we're going to be doing a lot of shows at the fly fishing show, you know, some of the tickets that you're giving away.
Right.
We and a lot of other great, great lodges, not just me. I mean, I'm lucky I can go to the best lodges in the world. But the best lodges in the world, most of them are at Fremsky's fly fishing show. And they're starting in Denver, I think, on January the 6th, and they go through March. And there's 7 different locations around the country, and we'll be at all of those giving shows for on brook trout, like for the Coopers. I'm doing one for the Big River, and I do some on my own where I talk about just the best places on the planet to fish for various species, and I'm really targeting the char. And the reason that I'm targeting the char is I think they're the most underrated game fish on the planet. You know, A.J. McLean, who used to be Field and Stream's editor in chief, and one of the greatest writers, and you know, and freshwater fly fisherman ever. He said that the best, the toughest freshwater game fish was an Arctic char. That they were the fastest and the hardest fighting of all the game fish. He called them the cheetah of the north. And my sons and my book, at the end, the last chapter, we're going to rank all of these Samanidae, like which ones do we think are the toughest. So we'll have to buy the book to see if we agree with AJ. But I'll tell you, the char are up there.
They're up there. Yeah.
I'll give you one fast story. I fell in love with a landlocked char. I didn't even hardly know what they were, but in the 80s, I was fishing. I had brought in Drs. Richard Heydrich and Laurie Thompson to study, you know, the trout and the char. And I saw a huge char that was leading a pod of char, and he was made one of the best casts I ever made. And he just came up, and he took the big drake pattern that I had, and just kept going, and he never slowed down. And I didn't worry because I'm a fanatic about putting a lot of backing on my reel, and at that time I had a streamlined 3N reel, you know, 3 inches. I had a couple hundred yards of backing on there. And the long story short, he never really got excited because when you get a char, first thing they do is have a blistering run, and then they're up in the air. He just leisurely went along, and all of a sudden I ran out of backing, and we had to start the boat, and we got it started too late, and ping. Second time in my life I was ever spooled, you know, by
wow.
A fish. I mean, I couldn't even slow him. And again, even back then, I taught techniques and tactics, and this is what you do to, you know, to turn. I mean, and that fish never even noticed that I was there. I mean, it was I couldn't believe it. I was stunned, you know.
Yeah.
It was a lesson in humility, believe me.
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. Well, a couple last things to finish up here. You've mentioned a couple of times working with Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans,
yes.
And with tagging and genetic testing. So what do you hope to accomplish with that? Tell us where you're going with that.
The bottom line is some of these fish are unique, and some of them need protection. You know, the first two, of course, you know, the menapee, the giant brook trout, and the landlocked Arctic char. There's also fish like that over in, you know, several of the other lakes. Jim Burton has a lake where there's just, you know, tremendous fish in, and he's done some great work, and his father, you know, Vince, has done some, you know, great job in protecting them. And that's Igloo Lake. So I'm interested in getting those brook trout and those char identified as unique morphs so they can be further protected. The Burtons for two generations, the Coopers for 38 years have protected those species, but they may not be there in perpetuity. So I want to see that these are recognized as unique species and protected. Secondarily, nobody's paid any attention to the sea run trout. You'll have really strict requirements on how many Atlantic salmon you can catch and so forth. Sea-run brook trout, the limit might be for a day 40 pounds, you know, 40 fish or 40 pounds, things like that. And I know people, they come in, they want a food fish. Even the natives, the indigenous people, they'll just go up and they're good, they're vulnerable, and they'll just go in and hammer them. So I want to get, one, have them noticed, you know, have them noticed as a premier game fish. They fight like the Dickens. They fight as hard as salmon. I mean, I was catching one in Rattling Brook once that I was maybe, 4 feet above the water on a outcropping of granite. And I had one salter jump up next to me twice. You know, because brook trout, you think, well, they don't really jump, and they don't. These are absolutely tremendous fish. So what I'm trying to do is, one, learn. You know, we've learned so much. For example, William Flick, when he did his studies for Cornell, and many, many after him, they looked at a lot of the fish that we're looking at, and they said, this is what they do. This is what they eat. This is how long they live. et cetera, et cetera. This is how they mate. This is when they spawn. This is why they get this big and so forth. Basic, and he was a wonderful, great man, and so his son, Art. But the bottom line is, through our research, we've dispelled basically everything. You know, we learned way more. Like Art thought, William Flick thought that, like the Menapee trout were just invertebrate eaters. They eat anything. I mean, I catch them on these giant mouse or rat or lemming patterns to 6 and 7 inches long, and have them crush it. Just because of their behavior, for example, learning through all of this research. 2 years ago, I went up and told their head guide, Ray Best. I said, Ray, I'm going to go out and catch a world record. He laughed. He says, we haven't caught a world record here. We have them all in years, you know. I did. It was a 9-pound, 10-ounce brookie, and I lost a bigger one. This summer, my son Jeff and I went out. Because of the knowledge that we had, we went and found what we think is the rarest salmonoid on this planet, these landlocked Arctic char, and in a horrific day, rain, vertical rain, we caught a 9.5-pound male. And we've discovered, in doing our research, we've discovered another area where they spawn, and one of the things that I'm going to be doing in the Menapee this year is looking for another area where I think these landlocked Arctic char are spawning. You know, we thought back when Richard Heydrich and Laurie Thompson, we took did some research to try to determine what the numbers of these fish were. And we came up in that whole watershed that there were maybe 400 to 500. We revised that, my son Jeff and I. We think there's maybe twice that many. We don't know if they've, just because we've found, you know, new areas where they're at, or because the Coopers haven't had any fishing going on whatsoever in some of the areas that they're in for many years. We're not sure why, but all we know is there are a lot more fish there. So it's a lot of reasons. Our basic research, though, other than getting them protected, is when you find out, the more you find out about the fish, the more you find out techniques to catch them.
One final question here. Don in California wrote in. He says, is it possible for civilian anglers to take a fin clipping or something and send it off to universities or county labs to get DNA or other things like toxins analyzed?
I'd say no. I would say no. I wouldn't do it. You might get, if you get something that's rare, you get a bull trout or try to do a fin clip, you know. What I would do is I would write, if he was in California, did you say, Roger?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'd check with, UCLA or Southern Cal or maybe even go north of that, and I would ask. I would get involved, and I would ask. For example, I know I was a consultant for DFO in the early 90s when I applied for my experimental scientific permit this year. My first time through, I got turned down. And I have a pretty impressive resume. You know, when we did our research in the 80s and 90s, you didn't need a permit back then. But I had to go back and say, well, I'm an American. You know, I'm as far as we know, Jeff and I are the first Americans that ever get a permit. You know, so they want to know, you know, that why they want to know what is your experience and what are you trying to accomplish? And you have to have a pretty darn good story to tell them. I told the head of fisheries for the DOF that after I got turned down, as I said, you know, years ago when you wanted to know what the rules and the regulations would be and what the requirements were, you asked me. Now you turn me down. I would say
okay.
No. I would. If I were he, call and ask. Call one of the universities, or call fisheries. They'll help them.
Yeah, probably if you ran into something you thought was a little offbeat or whatever, call the local fisheries and mm-hmm. let them know, and then maybe.
And a lot of times they're not. I was asked to go up to fish a lake and Mackenzie River, and in their lake they thought they had three different types of lake trout. And as soon as I looked at them, immediately, they were splake. They were just brook trout, lake trout hybrids. So
yeah.
A lot of times you look at something and you think, boy, this is really weird. And it isn't weird, you know. And,
yeah.
you know, to me it was, you know, all I had one look and I knew. I mean, it was a it was a pretty easy thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's time to wrap it up here. Run out of time. Stick with me for a few more minutes, everyone. We're going to give away the one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, a copy of Tom's book, Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish, courtesy of Stackpole Books, and tickets for 2 days for the fly fishing show somewhere in the U.S. So stick with me a couple more minutes, and we'll give all those prizes away. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon run. It's time to stop the Chuitna Coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.chuitna.org. That's C-H-U-I-T-N-A.org, chuitna.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. This is, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We really appreciate it. But now it's time to give away a few prizes. And the winners for the two drawings are selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do it for the next show so you don't miss out on chances to win some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and figure out how we can get these prizes to you. So the first thing we're going to give away this evening is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. It's a great organization to support and be part of. So let me fire up the computer here and have it make the first selection, and that's going to be Harold Brown in British Columbia. Harold Brown in British Columbia. So congratulations, Harold. We'll get you that membership set up. And the second thing is the one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. One-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and that is going to be Joe DePinto. Joe DePinto. So congratulations, Joe. He's in Colorado. And congratulations on winning that. So now, to give away Tom's book and also tickets to the fly fishing show. Now, as Tom was saying, there's fly fishing shows coming up January and February in Denver, Colorado, Marlborough, Massachusetts, Somerset, New Jersey, Atlanta, Georgia, Linwood, Washington, Pleasanton, California, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So Colorado, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Georgia, Washington, California, and Pennsylvania. If you win tonight and don't plan on going, let me know and we'll pick a second winner here. But hopefully you're in some vicinity of going to one of these shows and can make it to the show. So what we're going to do, the question is going to be twofold, two-part question. And let me clear my queue there just to make sure. You answer the question on our homepage and of our website. And the question is, first part of the question is, which char had a bounty on it? And the second question is, which one of the chars is probably the most endangered char? So, two-part question. I need both parts right in the order that I just asked them. So I'll be specific about that. And we'll see, Tom, here, who our winner is. Second place, we'll give the first place Tom's book, and the second place we'll give away the fly fishing tickets, 2 days to the fly fishing show. Okay, come on. Go, type fast. Um, no, I don't think this is it. Dolly Varden and Landlocked Arctic Char. One, number one is right, but number two isn't right, is it, Tom?
No, it is. They're
right?
The fewest of them. You know, bull trout are the most endangered.
That's what I was looking for, yeah. Okay. So we got a second winner here, Dolly and endangered bull trout. And so I would say, Daniel, you won. Daniel Inns, Sunnyvale, California. So you got a copy of Tom's book and Saltwater's Greatest Game Fish. And let's see if we have another winner here. And we've got Victor Hahn in Golden, Dolly Varden in bull trout. Exactly what I was looking for. Victor's in Golden, Colorado, so you got no excuse. You're going to be at the Denver show, and you're going to get a couple of free tickets for 2 days there. So congratulations, and be sure to look Tom up when you're there and say hi. Thanks, Tom, for setting that up for me.
And Roger, if you send me the address of the winner, I'll autograph the book for them and send it myself.
Right, right. So we'll need to, Daniel, just send me your, in that text box that you answered the question in, send me your address, and we'll get that off to Tom, and he'll get that book autographed and signed and over to you. So, and if any of you want to get Tom's book autographed or whatever, then go to the Fly Fishing Show. Are you going to be in the author's booth as well,
yes.
Tom, or are you just going to?
Yes.
Okay. So definitely look him up there. You're going to be at which ones now, Tom?
All of them. Yep.
All of them. Oh, wow.
Yep.
That's quite an agenda.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a U.S. tour there that you're doing. Well, good, good. Well, thanks, everybody, for playing. Tom, it was a pleasure having you on the show again. You're just like a walking encyclopedia when it comes to fishing, and it's just wonderful to hear everything you have to say. And I know
Roger,
just,
it was my pleasure. You run a great show, and it's a service to the fly fishing community. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. That's the way I look at it, too. And it's always a joy to learn more. And like you say, it's a lifelong thing, you know, to learn. So
yes, sir.
Always something to learn. Well, next time on our show on December 21st, we're going to have at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern time, we're going to have Bruce Chard. The topic for the show will be tarpon on the worm. Bruce is a professional guide in the Florida Keys, and he's going to take us for a ride to the Palolo Worm Hatch. This once-a-year event will get anybody's adrenaline pounding, and so join us to find out where, when, and how to fish this incredible event. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, the Motto Books, Stackpole Books, Watermaster, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give me a call at 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit the website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.